On behalf of the Delaware and Pittsburgh Lawyers Chapters, I'd like to welcome you to today's event, which is titled, When Politics is a Firing Offense, Do Anti-Discrimination Laws Push Employers to Restrict Free Speech? For those that don't know me, my name is Ryan Costa. I am the president of the Federalist Society's Delaware Lawyers Chapter, and it is my honor today to introduce our two fantastic speakers. First, let me introduce Walter Olson, who will be speaking first this afternoon. Wally Olson is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute's Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies and is known for his writing on the American legal system. He has written several books, including The Rule of Lawyers on Mass Litigation and The Excuse Factory on lawsuits in the workplace. He was also the founder and principal writer of what was one of the oldest and most popular law blogs, the recently retired overlawyer.com. Also with us today is Professor Todd Zwicky. To name just a handful of his credentials, Professor Zwicky is a George Mason University Foundation Professor of Law at the Antonin Scalia Law School, Senior Scholar of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and Senior Fellow at the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. He served as chair of the Association of American Law School Section on Law and Economics in 2019, and from 2003 to 2004, Professor served as the director of the Office of Policy Planning at the Federal Trade Commission. He's also the author of more than 110 articles in leading law reviews and peer-reviewed economics journals, and consistently recognized as one of the most read and most cited law authors. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Walter, but as just one final note before I do that, we will be doing a Q&A at the end of their talk. So if you have a question now or as the conversation continues, please type it into the Q&A box you should see at the bottom of the screen, and we'll do our best to get to it. All right, with that, thank you. And gentlemen.
Well, thank you, Ryan. Thank you to the Federalist Chapters and of course to all of you for coming out today, and to Todd, I should say that this is not couched as a debate, it's a discussion. It may be that we will agree on too much, although I hope we will keep it entertaining anyway. It's always the danger if you agree on too much. But we'll see where it goes and see whether any differences do emerge. What I'd like to start by doing is by asserting an obnoxious author's prerogative, and I will let you all decide whether the word obnoxious modifies prerogative or author's in that case, but to read from his own writing, because I've written quite a bit about the issues that I think we're mostly going to be talking about today on speech in the workplace and the incentives, the economic incentives for restricting that. And so let me turn to a passage. I'm sorry, I'm just getting lost in my navigation here. Starts out talking about what I call a regime of orthodoxy in the workplace, and mentions sensitivity training, which is required in places like Connecticut for private company managers, and how there had been a big public reaction against the shame and blame tone of a lot of this diversity training. Big New York Times article on this going on in Seattle, where the ferry system had spent millions of dollars on compulsory training and was described as shock therapy, a kind of cultural boot camp, but it had left the ferry workers, quote, more polarized than before. Huge backlash, tons of anger, to quote one supporter. We used to be all ferry workers, but now everyone's divided up into little groups. Complaints of harassment soared instead of dropping, as was intended. And soon the state was paying out $800,000 in settlements to the newly angered workers who were beginning to hire lawyers for their grievances. And workers interviewed at the ferry system said they were afraid to talk to each other, and some supervisors said they hesitated to give orders. Trainers, however, this is my favorite bit, were unrepentant. We have moved them from denial to resistance, said one. We consider that a healthy move. So, you know, workplace in ruins, but the trainers are so happy as they step away from the rubble. Anyway, and then beyond the training comes the individual demands for orthodoxy. An attorney was quoted on this in a business magazine. Accusers are believed on the basis of very little evidence or none at all, she said. And the ultimate punishment, termination, is a first resort rather than a last one. And a business professor at a prominent university in the East tells of running into a surprise when he gave his students a case study meant to illustrate the handling of a modern workplace conflict. And the case study was an example of a genteel older man who's been with the company for many years. He persists in calling younger women honey and dear, no question of ever laying a hand on anyone, but he uses this kind of out of date at best language. And a few newer female hires have mentioned that they find it annoying to hear him use that sort of terminology. So how should the company handle things? Well, the professor had expected, using this case study, classroom discussion to unfold along the following lines, you know, that what would be diplomatic or maybe even humorous ways to just let him know that he needs to, you know, listen to what his words sound like and not step on his feelings, but just get him to, you know, step into the current age a little more. But he was surprised to find that his students' reaction was completely different. That was not at all what they were recommending. They said, the reaction was unanimous. It was prompt. It was emphatic. Company has to get rid of him, and quickly, before the company landed in real trouble. And the only question was whether to try to buy him out or build a paper trail to nail him. And then the New York Times came out with a report with similar things. Well, you probably sense that I've been holding back a surprise, which is that these are not contemporary reports. This is from the book, The Litigation Explosion, which you should all run out and buy on eBay, if eBay will still let you buy it. And it was published in 1998. It was published a whole generation ago. All these things were happening when members of the Federalist Society student chapters were still unborn in many cases. And so that leaves us with some questions. What has changed and what hasn't changed since 1998, since so much of what we are disturbed about, what grips us with angst, was already happening then. And I certainly agree, and probably we will all agree, that something has changed. The situation is different. It is more intense. It is a grievance that has risen around the top of conservative worries about the state of the world, where it certainly wasn't, I can tell you, in 1998, or I would have sold a whole lot more copies back then. And I'm not saying this just in order to boast of how prescient I was and how, well, okay, maybe a little bit. I'm doing it to boast of that. But the fact is that with all of these same general phenomena going on, it was at most a mid-range issue rather than a top-of-mind issue for the people worried about excessive government involvement. So let me sketch out some things that might have changed or not changed since then, and then I'll move into questions of what, if anything, might be done about it, because that's an open-ended area that we could talk about all day. But first, what is different and what is the same between now and 1998? And I will say, the first thing I always turn to is the state of the law. And I will say that for the most part, and obviously you can find some exceptions, the law of the workplace and harassment and hostile work environment has not actually changed all that much since then. There hasn't been a huge toughening. You can find particular areas where it has, but that I don't think is the main variable. And and we'll get into the law a little bit more, a lot more, but there's a second possibility, which seemed plausible to me, which is, well, okay, back then, these were insurance offices or whatever, where people felt that they couldn't talk about race, which I give various examples from back then where they couldn't talk about various issues that people could sue about. for fear of creating a hostile environment. But no, there were lots of examples back then of media workplaces. That is to say, what might seem the new development, where it's being asserted not just as a personnel matter, but also against things like the printing of editorials, the printing of op-ed pieces, the curriculum adopted by particular professors. In other words, it's penetrating not just from quotidian water cooler conversation to things related to the mission of why people are at the institution, things like what the magazine or broadcast station is allowed to communicate, or what people are allowed to teach at the university. Those might seem like the newest wrinkle that distinguished 2020 and 2021. The fact is they were going on back then too. I could fill your chat session with examples of people who were trying to file suits over things like choice of article, choice of news topics to cover at a media organization, or choice of curriculum by someone teaching at a university. Now, it is true that the demands back then mostly failed. That is, that media organizations generally resisted and did not go along with demands that they change their article diet from younger staffers or others. So that's something that has changed. It's not that the demands weren't being made then, but that they were typically unsuccessful then. And now they're not so unsuccessful. So that's a clue to bear in mind. Now, a couple of other things, though, that have changed that I really am convinced are an important part of the explanation for why things are so much different now. One of them is simply that, remember those students that the professor was talking about who surprised him by saying, no, fire him, fire him, fire him. Well, they're 23 years older. Now they're middle managers. Now they're running HR departments. Back then they were a small and not really terribly influential fringe in the companies that were hiring them. Now they are up there, perhaps a majority, or at least a majority in areas like public affairs and HR. So that I think is worth pursuing as something where things have changed. And something else obviously that we're going to get on the table, so I'll put it out right now, that has changed is in 1998, there was by and large no social media to create a mob effect. There might be protests from a few younger staffers, but there was no way, A, to organize it and get 1,000 likes, and B, to make sure that it's seen by whatever news organization can deal a devastating reputational blow to the employer by reporting on that internal dissension. Now there is. We all know about that. So I'll leave that there because I suspect Todd will agree, and perhaps no one will disagree, that this is one of the huge things that has changed between 1998 and now. So let me move from the question of then and now to the question of how exactly does this operate? Because it's important. I've mentioned HR departments a lot, and I've mentioned hostile work environment law. But this, I think, gets us closer to the heart of what we need to talk about today, because it was true as a matter of the doctrine being propounded in the law schools, even in 1998, that there was no safe harbor or bright line rule for when you were in a hostile work environment, for when someone 3 years from now suing over lack of promotion or over constructive discharge might be able to reach back and say, you know, there was that terrible joke that someone told, there was that awful picture that they put up on their bulletin board. Those things were being offered even back then as evidence in complaints to the EEOC. They were occasionally being pled as evidence in subsequent lawsuits. But then as now, there is no safe harbor calculation. It is instead a vague kind of balancing test in which every little bit of speech or expression of opinion, not in itself enough to give rise to liability, that no one could have had a successful lawsuit about in itself, could nonetheless be brought in as evidence as part of a pattern and practice if you were talking about a larger suit, or as part of the environment of a particular worker who was suing over individualized damages. And this creates, and at some level, it's an interesting question of whether it was intended to create a kind of fog of noncompliance. I describe it as paddling ever closer toward the fabled shores of compliance, only to see them recede like a mirage. The harder you try to paddle toward them, business can never, in fact, comply. It can improve its odds, a phrase that I keep returning to, by doing lots of training and recording that everyone has attended a training session. It can improve its odds by requiring anything to be taken down off a bulletin board, that is going to offend anyone whatsoever, even if it's not a typical employee. It can improve its odds by adopting a dozen other measures, which you will think of, but it can't actually comply. All it can do is to try to improve the odds. And so here we get back to the question of why there is an incentive to be so extraordinarily punitive to people who have not crossed a legal line, whose behavior could not in itself be sued over, but who have gotten closer to the line than other employees, so that someone among the younger employees objects. It's not even that any of the younger employees wanted to sue over that older gentleman in the original example. It's that the students understood, even if their professor did not at some level, that if push ever came to shove with someone's claim of a workplace tainted by sexism or racism, that the company would be dragged down, but even if it had tried to do a dozen other things right, if it had not acted as soon as it found out about that older gentleman. So you have a system here, and it's not just, of course, workplace compliance that works this way. Some of the legal climate of universities works this way. Some of the legal climate moving away from claims of discrimination. It is often said that no one in the banking or pharmaceutical industries will criticize their government regulators because there is simply too much discretion, and there are simply too many ways in which a lifted eyebrow could ruin your business prospects. And we can talk about the extent to which, with federal contractors or others, the auditors that come from Washington are part of this. My own instinct is that they can't be too big a part of it, or else there would be a bigger difference between the outcomes under the Obama administration and the Trump administration, for example. And so far as I can see, it didn't actually lighten up the workplace atmosphere. The fact that the DOL inspectors at federal contractors were under somewhat different marching orders under the Trump years. But these are reasons why, as we move into the area of what make good policy recommendations, I know that there's tremendous resistance to, as some would put it, backing the horse out of the barn the way that he came in, by actually going back and trying to challenge and roll back some of the doctrines in employment discrimination law that got us where we are. Instead, the solution of the moment for many of my conservative friends is, we should overlay new causes of action and rights to sue over the adverse action based on political opinion. Now, we can talk about that. One clue there is that a number of jurisdictions already have such language on the books, and we can go see whether in the District of Columbia or in California it actually has worked in the way that conservatives hope that it will work. But I would just say it's an open question to me. I don't know how passing new and extremely punitive new employment laws from the other direction would necessarily work. It hasn't exactly been tried. As a libertarian, my instinct is to wave my arms in warning, saying, don't assume that government action has the consequences that you expect of it. Don't assume that plunging further into government and judicial second guessing of employment decisions, taking us ever farther away from employment at will, don't assume that the conservatives will be happy with where that winds up. But again, as I say, I don't really know how it will come out. I would just say that I've probably exhausted my time and should turn things over to Todd. So Todd, you're up.
Thank you, Walter. And shame on anybody who doesn't already have a copy of the Litigation Explosion on their shelf. You're not allowed to have mine. That's right. Don't look for my copy on eBay because my dog-eared copies here on my shelf. So thank you for that. And as Walter mentioned, he's been working on this for a very long time. And I'm going to come at this from a little bit of a different perspective because I'm not an employment lawyer, but where my background is in financial services. And this has been an issue I've been following in recent years. And so I'm going to come at it from and raise some questions that really picks up where Walter leaves off. And that's the question I think is very useful, which is Walter asked whether we're going to have much disagreement, and the answer is still maybe. But one area on which I think we'll not have a disagreement is that we both agree that this is a really big problem. It's been a problem for a while, but seems to be a bigger problem for the reasons that he talked about. Not only does society seem to be more litigious, but we have what essentially amounts now to vigilante justice in the form of social media mobs is sort of latching on to this stuff without anything that resembles due process, burden of proof. How many times have we heard stories where something happens and the initial story when somebody basically gets attacked turns out to be incomplete or untrue or whatever. And so there really is a heightened concern about this. And that then in turn causes employers to panic. And do things either to sort of CYA to save themselves from litigation or to save themselves from bad publicity by basically throwing somebody to the wolves, figuring that in the long run or even in the short run, that will get the mob off their back. And so I think we're in agreement that this is a problem. It's a bigger problem. And I think the question for all of us who are concerned about the rule of law and individual liberty and in the free market economy and freedom of contract is what should we do about it? And I'm very sympathetic to the same starting point where I think Walter is very sympathetic to, which is the traditional idea of employment at will. And there's a starting point. And the logic there is pretty compelling, which is in a competitive marketplace, you would think that that there would be, you know, no incentives really to discriminate because companies that discriminate and, you know, treat their employees badly will have trouble attracting employees. And that in turn involves discriminating against people based on their political beliefs when that bears no resemblance to their work performance and the like. And so in a world where we had sort of traditional freedom of contract, where we had openness, where there weren't significant barriers to entry in the economy and that sort of thing, those sorts of problems would basically resolve themselves. And so in the first best world, I think, I won't speak for Walter, but I think in the first best world, both he and I would think, well, this really isn't a problem, or this is a problem that takes care of itself in a first best world where there's freedom of entry, freedom of contract, and, you know, this will all get sorted out and employers and employees will match up and that sort of thing. The question I wonder now about is we are clearly not in the first best world right now, in the sense that what we have is a very heavily regulated economy. We have a very heavily regulated workplace. We have very heavy regulations on entry, or, you know, in both employee hiring and firing and all these sorts of things. And what we essentially, and so we're clearly into the second world of the second best. And as economists have always known, the best solution in the world of the first best is not necessarily the best solution in the world of the second best. And so the way we can think about this is, if we all agree that there's a problem, the problem is getting worse, it still remains an open question as to what is the solution? How should we best address that? As Walter suggested, is the best thing to say, don't do anything, not because we couldn't imagine a better world, but because in practice, there might not, you know, we might not be able to accomplish a better world once the machinery of politics and the litigation machine takes over? Or is there some solution which kind of makes us a little bit queasy as libertarians that might end up you know, sort of from a cost benefit analysis, actually improve the matter. And I agree with Walter. It's an open question and something that should be hard, that we should think about in a sort of, you know, clear-eyed way at this point, because it cuts across all of the issues that keep us awake these days, right? Whether it's social media and the cancellation of Parler, and the extent to and the impact that has on freedom of speech and that sort of thing, or the particular area that's caught my attention, which is financial services. And so we can think about it, one extreme, the traditional private employer-employee relationship governed by employment at will. And we can think about, to some extent, at the other extreme, well, the far other extreme, obviously, is direct government employment, right, which is covered by the First Amendment. But abutting right up to that very closely, I would say, would be banking, which is banking is a system which is basically a public utility in all but name. There are very strict barriers to entry. During the introduction, somebody mentioned banking and where these issues have arisen, which is that it's hard to get a banking charter. Supervision in the banking system basically, you know, is a shadow form of law where, without any judicial review, usually without any sort of due process, banking regulators can put the screws to you. And if you don't believe me, read John Allison's book about the financial crisis, where BB&T was basically threatened with being shut down if they didn't accept TARP funds that they didn't want. Or look at the miserable experience with Operation Choke Point during the Obama administration, where the banking regulators told banks that it would create a, quote, reputation risk, unquote, for them to provide banking and payment services to completely legitimate and legal businesses such as payday lenders, online pornography companies, fireworks, arms, gun dealers, people like that. That was, government basically shutting off access to financial services. And you can't have a business basically without some access to the ability to be able to bank and clear checks and clear payments and that sort of thing. They basically were trying to destroy, and that's why they called it Operation Choke Point, choking off the air that they needed to breathe. So there's some sense in which, and now what we see is banks under the pressure of activist groups, saying we're not going to fund fossil fuels, we're not going to fund manufacturers. And as many of you probably know, Donald Trump's personal checking account was closed by his bank down in Florida. And once somebody gets their bank account closed, it's really hard to find somebody who'll provide you with a bank account. So the OCC promulgated a rule at the end of the Trump administration that would do what Walter described for the employment sector, which would basically say that you can't discriminate on the basis of non-financial circumstances in a bank account. You can't decide not to provide services to fossil fuel companies or to Donald Trump or whatever. Now, again, it raises the same question. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? But we can see the way in which banking starts to merge with what essentially amounts to government activity. It's so closely intertwined that it's a plausible sort of thing. So let's think about employment law writ large then. Does it look more like sort of a traditional employment at will world where we don't really need these protections and they would clearly be more harmful than useful? Or does it start to look like the banking world in which it's so riven and so interwoven with regulatory oversight and regulatory tentacles that we start to think, well, maybe this is something in which we need to have some protections because maybe the market isn't going to work very well. I think there's reason to believe that that marketplace is pretty tilted, and it's pretty tilted in a way in which it's at least worth thinking about. In the world of the second best, are we better off with something like Walter described, which is preventing on the basis of ideological beliefs or freedom of speech for non-work related activity. Nowadays, for example, only a very small fraction of the workforce is actually covered by employment at will in any meaningful way, right? Which is protected classes, I think, that compose probably, Walter probably knows the number better than me, 75% of the workforce, over 40, minority, woman, disabled, you name it, right? A vast majority of the workforce is not employment at will, which means employment at will basically exists more or less for white males under the age of 40, right? So start with that. We know the second thing is that the way in which, are you signing up for that, Ryan? The way in which that operates in practice turns out to be far from neutral is what we've discovered now. And this is the point in which I think we can all intuitively recognize that this has gotten worse. So think about an example, which is say that just think about the possibility that a white male supervisor says something on social media that some people are offended by at work. And let's assume that most people say they should not reasonably be offended by it, just for purposes of simplicity. It has nothing to do with it's at work. Well, you can ask the guy who was, the guy who was fired, I've forgotten his name, the guy who was, Eric, what's his name, was fired as the CEO of Mozilla, right? He was hired as the CEO of Mozilla. His tax, the tax returns were released that showed that he donated to a the initiative in California to reinstate traditional marriage. He got fired, right? Basically based on the fact that the people at the work complained, right? Now let's think about the possibility that instead of that he donated to say BLM, right? So basically what you have is a man who donates to one thing gets fired basically because they say, well, he's not, people are uncomfortable working with him now for his expression of his political views, without anything more, not expressing any animus towards gay couples, not expressing any animus toward any protected class. But think about if it's the other way around, right? And so now we start getting into this situation in which the reality is that this does tend to get applied in a unequal manner. And as the title of this session says, does the operation of anti-discrimination laws basically put a weight on the scale that basically sort of says, in so many words, certain groups end up getting more protection for their speech than other groups, especially for speech that's not related in any direct way to what goes on in the workforce. And if that's the reality, and it certainly doesn't seem intuitively implausible that that's the reality, that this, in fact, this ends up getting applied in an unequal fashion, then I think we start to ask the question, which is this traditional dichotomy we thought about between private on one side and public on the other, is that more of a continuum? Does the playing field get so sort of intertwined with regulation and rules that end up creating an uneven playing field that maybe it's worth thinking about whether we want to intervene and basically try to rebalance that playing in a field in a fashion that might be appropriate? Like Walter, I'm still somewhat agnostic on this. I'm relatively confident in the context of banking that maybe there's probably more we should do given the nature of that. I'm not sold yet on the idea of employment, but it's at least worth thinking about. And I'm not sold for the internet, for example, either, right? Although I think it's at least worth thinking about. You kind of go through all these areas in which all this sort of regulation applies. But I think it's at least worth thinking about. And I think that we should be thinking more generally about this traditional dichotomy between public and private as being more of a continuum. And what does that mean in the world of the second best? So I'll close with one final thought, which is what keeps me awake at night about this. Brendan Eich, that was the guy's name at Mozilla, right? When that incident happened, that was like kind of a chill down my spine, which is that was looking into the future as to what this looks like, right? And what I knew immediately when they said, we're firing him because he don't made this political donation, I said, that is not a stable equilibrium, right? It can't be that it's okay if he doesn't donate money, but if he votes for it. There's no plausible stopping point between that and basically saying you have to vote against the referendum, and people could ask you that, and deciding whether to hire you or donate money to the other side. I just don't think that sort of conceptually, the way the world is today, that's a stable equilibrium. What I do think we need to have, though, and this is where I don't know if the genie can be put back in the bottle, which is, we live under a system of democratic capitalism, right? There are two aspects of that. There's democratic and there's capitalism. And Milton Friedman in Capitalism and Friedman said, you know, the beauty of our system is when I buy a bushel of grain, I don't care whether it was, you know, grown by a Jew, a Hindu, or a black person or a woman or whatever, right? We disentangle our, when we go into the political marketplace and when we express our views, we traditionally have had a view in the United States that view of exercising your public duties as a citizen in the democratic part have largely been disentangled from what you do in the capitalism part, which is how you vote and how you participate in the political process and how you exercise your speech outside of work is something that is isolated from whether or not you have the right to make a living. And it is a very slippery slope between whether you vote for Trump and whether you should be allowed to be a mid-level manager at a Fortune 500 company, and what religion you practice and whether you should do that, and all the other sorts of horror stories you can start thinking about, which is how do people express their identity as individuals in the democratic constitutional process, and to what extent should that interfere with their ability to make a living in the private sector? I think in the world of the first best, people would actually treat that distinction in a principled and responsible way and tolerate each other's views with that, even without affirming it. I don't know if we could put that genie back in the bottle, though. And so now we start searching for questions about the world of the second best, which I freely admit could potentially make things worse rather than better. So that's my thoughts.
So if I could weigh back in, because I've got a little string of several points that I wanted to either take issue with or at least vent my views on.
If you would, I just want to note that it's 12:40, so please offer your thoughts, but if you can try to keep it to 4 or 5 minutes, we'll then turn to Q&A.
I'll try to be brief. First, it is not, in fact, my position that we should do nothing. There are a bunch of potentially valuable steps, and Todd touched on one of them, for example, which is leveling the playing field so that insults directed in one direction are treated as seriously by hostile environment laws, insults in the other direction. Another is the Trump administration's initiative to go after training to make sure that it is not violating principles of anti-discrimination. So yes, there are plenty of things. In my book, I recommend learning from the NLRB, where it is part of labor law that expressing opinions on things not only is not going to be an unfair labor practice in itself, but can't be introduced as evidence of an unfair labor practice. Bingo, wonderful thing to import into discrimination law. So there are lots of things we can do that we haven't talked about. Secondly, I appreciate the second best analysis. My background is economics myself, and we've all got the example in our mind when we talk about the workplace of right to work laws. On paper, a violation of libertarian theory. In practice, if you assume that hardly any employers would voluntarily sign exclusive union contracts given their druthers, possibly a second best solution. And it maps onto this a bit. If you believe that there is no reason employers would ever cut off that employee or do the training other than fear of being sued. But if you believe that there are sometimes a range of sincere reasons, perhaps wanting to be better off with customers or perhaps wanting to keep the younger staff happy, that are legitimate reasons, sincere reasons, and perhaps ideologically motivated ones, the same reasons why private employers might want to fire a communist, by the way, they will be protected by these new legal principles. I think it's legitimate for a private employer to want to fire a communist. It's terrible. What a McCarthyite throwback I am to say that. But remember that you are cutting that off and that you are therefore interfering not merely with economic balancing, but also sometimes with statements of conscience when you try to tie employers' hands on this. So I'll stop there, but those are some differences, and I'm sure that others we can air in the Q&A section.
Let me turn the mute button off and then get to our first question. The first question is from Anonymous, and it is, what do you make of the Trump administration's actions on racial sensitivity training, the resulting litigation, and the Biden administration's about face? I don't know if either one of you want to take a crack at that first.
I kind of just did. I thought that was one of the more promising things the Trump administration did, and I'm sorry that the Biden administration pulled the plug. And I don't know if anything from Todd or...
Yeah, I think so too, but I think it is a good example of this trade-off, which is, you know, basically the pushback that you got from a lot of corporations was, this should be up to us, right? We should decide what the best way is for our manage our workforces. And it basically frames up the question in another way. I tend to come down on the idea that it was probably a pretty good idea. But again, I recognize the counter argument, which was that it was basically the same pushback we've been describing. Of course, there it was basically saying, if you want to deal with the federal government, then you've got to play by our rules. And that pretty nicely illustrates the sense in which, you know, government kind of gets entangled with a lot of these private sector decisions.
It was the contractor angle, which does make it different, as Todd says. And there is also the fact that the EEOC and other agencies have committed to a view of hostile work environment, which pretty clearly makes some of that training itself a hostile work environment. So I don't find that a stretch or a reach for them. They're basically saying, we're not changing the rules, but we're just making sure that you're following the rules that we have already announced.
Right.
See, the next question is from David Spalding, who asks, how much of these problems that we're discussing are real actual legal problems versus a matter of just management and labor council cowardice?
Well, you know, it's easy to be brave with someone else's company. You know, Todd was talking, and boy, did I ever feel this. I think we're on the same wavelength as far as these banks, and I mentioned pharmaceutical companies that see something terrible going on. They'd love to blow the whistle about it, but it's not their money. It's the shareholders' money. It's a whole enterprise that could be tanked if you take a step that is right in principle, but you know, gets you in trouble with the authorities. So again, you know, there's something here. I think that much of the conservative pushback on these things comes from the fact that the ones they sympathize with, and often the only one whose lawyers they listen to, are the dissident employees who are getting the short end of the stick. And I sympathize with them too, and I want to listen to them too. But listen a little to the voices from corporate America. And it's inevitably more complicated. You know, we can be sending covert or open support to the ones who are on the right side within these intra-corporate debates. But if we just come out and do business bashing, you know, they are more politically powerful. You know, it is remarkable that somewhere there is an American Constitution Society lunch seminar saying that the right is controlled by corporate America's wishes. And we all know that it's very different from that. This is one of those paradoxical instances in which to make progress, I think you actually need to listen to both the managers and the dissidents in order to find a way forward that isn't impractical or won't be slapped down. by the opposition forces.
Yeah, that's a marvelous response, especially the first part, that it's easy to be brave with other people's companies. But it does point out the issue, I think. And this is even more in, you know, historically, it's been even worse in universities than it has been in corporations. Right now, corporations seem to be at the front of the line because they're the ones who can, you know, pay Robin DiAngelo $50,000 and get away with it. But now corporations seem to be leading the band to some extent. But it is a basic problem, right? And the basic problem is a well-known one. You know, we're both economists by thinking and training, right? Which is that what's optimal in the short run may not be optimal in the long run. In the short run, and what the activists always count on is it's always in the short run benefit to cave. It's always in the short run benefit to avoid the public relations storm and throw somebody to the wolves or to try to quiet the dissident employees or to denounce Tom Cotton's column in the New York Times and to fire the editor, right? But as you proceed by that step by step, you end up in a very suboptimal end result. And if you were at the end and you're looking back, you might say to yourself, maybe we should have stood on principle in the first place, because once we caved on the principle, basically, we really are on the slippery slope on a lot of this. And the slippery slope gets much more slippery and accelerates nowadays in the world of social media, as Walter, I think, said very elegantly at the outset. And so what we have now is they think they could take one step and that'll quell the horde. But in fact, what we know is it basically just feeds a little bit of an appetizer to the alligator, and the alligator keeps coming back for more. And it's worse in universities, obviously, because the faculty basically have, you know, their utopian proposals sitting in their desk drawer. And as soon as one of these things flare up, they just have, you know, have their ready-made list of demands, and they use the students as basically the vanguard for that. And so the universities collapse like that, right? And the boards of those universities basically think, well, this is bad publicity. We don't need bad publicity for something as trivial as freedom of speech, is basically their view. And so we have this time problem. It's like bank bailouts. It's like a lot of other things. And, you know, in retrospect, I think they would all say it'd be better to take a principled stand on the front end, but that's not your job, right? A lot of times in universities, for example, problem is most presidents only last 3 to 5 years. And they're already looking forward to their next job. And the way to get your next job is not by creating a lot of controversy over something like freedom of speech in your current job. And so, so we really have this time inconstancy problem that makes it really hard to stand on principle, as the question posed the issue.
See, the next question is from Eugene Kerman, and this is a similar question and also an issue that I think you guys have both been grappling with this whole time. But he asks, can laws solve this? And in particular, he says, isn't it about conservative activists being far less vocal and far less organized and boycotting what they don't like compared to their liberal counterparts?
Well, why conservatives are so much less effective at it is an interesting question. I think that a lot of conservative effort has gone into boycotting Disney and boycotting General Mills. And, you know, I mean, you could make a very long list of attempts, nearly always pop guns that are forgotten later. Why is it that we are in a realm of such asymmetrical warfare, as my foreign policy buddies put it? I don't have a good answer on that. I simply observe it as part of the landscape, and it's some of it is probably something that could be cured in time, in that even as with public interest litigation, the liberal side had a 20 or 30 year head start, and eventually conservatives figured out quite well how to use a lot of the same levers and mechanisms, leveling the playing field and who could use the courts in that manner. Will something similar evolve on companies that behave in ways obnoxious to conservatives? Todd, do you have any ideas on that?
That's a great example about public interest litigation, where it was really pretty one-sided, and you know, and there's been some catch-up. No, but I think it's a very big problem. It's a big problem from the sense that now the left controls all of the commanding heights of society, right? This is a problem basically because the left controls American corporations. The left controls universities, the left controls most of the churches in the country now. They control the media, they control Hollywood. Basically, all of the commanding heights of the established, they control social media, quite obviously. Right now, and we are kind of asleep at the switch. And it's, you know, it's kind of hard to think about it. You know, one of the things I keep thinking about the Parler incident is basically the left said, well, if you don't like it, start your own version of Twitter. They started their own version of Twitter and then they got them shut down, right? It's like so much for that. And so, you know, it really is, you know, I think that, you know, there is a beauty to the public interest litigation example that Walter gave, which is that the courts remain to some extent a level playing field where it doesn't matter what goes on in the media. It doesn't matter what goes on in other places. You basically can still more or less get a fair hearing in front of fair judges. And obviously, you know, the bench is relatively balanced. But in sort of the culture wars and a lot of these other things, the punishment is only one party can really mete out punishment. And I think the second thing is only one party. I think the left is really, quite frankly, much more vicious and more willing to take no prisoners. I think a lot of us would balk at the idea that if somebody made a distasteful joke, that means they should lose their entire career and lose, you know, in the sort of things that they routinely call for in sort of cancel culture world. And I'm not saying we should go there. What I'm saying is that I think it is asymmetric in that sense. And the way in which we think about this is typically through a tit for tat lens. And tit for tat basically is the way you reestablish equilibrium. But it seems like the volume just keeps turned up and up and up and up. And it's really hard for a decent person to say we should go down the same path. So
let me push back a bit against the idea that the left controls all important institutions in society. It's this was, of course, not how it looked to them a couple of years ago when all three branches of the federal government, for example, there's a great old line from, I think it's P.J. O'Rourke, saying that America is a country where conservatives get to run the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Motors, and liberals get to run the Harvard Sociology Department and the Twilithorpe Dance Company. And both sides believe they've got the commanding heights of society. And I just want to press a little bit more because, of course, we remember the Boeing episode from a few months ago where a Boeing executive, fairly high up, was forced out of the company after it was revealed that, like 20 years ago, I mean, a long, long, long time ago, he wrote an article against women in combat, I think it was, at a point where that was not at all an off-the-fringe conservative idea. So if Boeing, you know, which builds, you know, really big metal things that blow up, they're not supposed to blow up, of course, but if Boeing it has an atmosphere like this, I would still say against going overboard in this respect, that there were times in the British Civil War when it seemed as if the Puritans or the Cavaliers had every institution on their side. And of course, it was because of hypocrisy. The Puritan sections of society learned to mouth a few royalist phrases when the alternative was to have their heads chopped off. And the Cavaliers learned to mouth the opposite set of canting phrases. Now, we currently are in a particular phase where at Boeing or the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you do have to mouth canting phrases in order to keep your job. I think that the nature of these institutions, you know, could spring back rather quickly with a little turn in the cultural tide, at which point people would be saying, oh, remember those wacky days of 2021, at least at Boeing and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they would be saying that. At the Harvard Sociology Department, the Twilithorpe Dance Company, they'd be saying, oh, we miss those days, but we can still keep them going here.
We're running short of time, so first for Todd, this is less a question than a comment, but notes that Brendan Eich, per Wikipedia, was not only the CEO, but also co-founded the Mozilla Project, which
Right.
Makes it even worse. I also add that he went on and started his own new browser called Brave, which if you have, if you don't want to use Google's, it's not a bad privacy-focused browser option. But we've got several questions, but I'll leave to one last one. This is from Alex Brown, who asks, what causes of action, theoretical or real, can employees that are thrown to the wolves, so to speak, possibly use to fight back against social media mob-based termination? And I'll add to that just on my own as the host with the prerogative to do so. How about employees that are forced to be subjected to critical race, right, training, be less white, things of that sort?
Well, Todd, do you want to go first, or because I have an answer also?
I'll say very briefly, but I'm really interested in your thought. I've been giving a lot of thought to this, right? And I think that I thought that the Trump administration statement on racial stereotyping was brilliant, and it was brilliant in a larger sense, which is that I think that there are things that our side can learn from Saul Alinsky, and in the sense that Saul Alinsky isn't necessarily just limited to tactics that the left can use. It's basically guerrilla tactics that people who are underdogs can use. And I thought that was a brilliant use of Alinskyite strategy, which is basically turning against the CRT people, their own premises, right, and trying to hold them to their own rules. And so something I've been thinking a lot about is, what are the ways in which, what are our options? What are the levers we can use? Walter noted that the EEOC has really been pretty decent on these rules, applying them equally for creating a hostile environment and that sort of thing. It's something that I think we probably haven't thought all the way through, how we might use that, how we might use private litigation, how we might use these different tactics that are at our disposal for whatever reason. We haven't thought strategically, or we've been reluctant to use it, or we've been embarrassed to use it. I don't have any answers, but I think that there are some interesting things that are worth us working out and thinking through more about how to use those techniques to try to bring back some balance for people. But I'd like to hear Walter's thoughts as the closing.
Well, there are certainly a bunch of things that I think are meritorious by people fired in these circumstances that would not require the creation of any new legal doctrine whatsoever. And on that business, again, if there has been training of, you should feel bad to be white, then if that serves as a tile in the mosaic of a so-called reverse discrimination suit, just as much as the reverse kind of record would serve for a conventional discrimination suit. First, let me once again flog my book, The Excuse Factory, because it's full of ideas on how to sue your employer. I actually have had plaintiff's lawyers thank me, saying that there were ideas for suing employers they hadn't thought of until they read my book. I felt very mixed feelings about that, although I love selling copies. But there are, for example, doctrines under which you can resort to your employment handbook, which is now 150 pages long because of all the disclaimers they've put in, so as not to have suits rely on the employment handbook. Let me just say, though, that I part company from Todd when he says that most employees are in protected groups. And here's why, or rather, no, he's right on that. But to say that most employment is not employment at will is where I part company from him, because most employees are indeed in protected categories, but they soon find that unless they can plausibly invoke difference based on that category, they remain employment at will for all other purposes. And you find this, for example, if you are a woman who complains about the terrible diversity training, you're not really presenting a sex-based suit. They would be happy to replace you with a woman who didn't mind the training. Likewise, if you are a Black man who objects to it, you don't actually have a racially based suit unless you're saying that you were made uncomfortable because you were Black. So all of a sudden, you realize if you were one of these people searching around for a cause of action after being fired, that even people who are in 2, 3, and 4 protected groups are still employees at will with respect to the issues we've been talking about here.
Good point. I'll leave that as the final note that we'll end on. I want to just thank everyone, the participants, for joining us today. Special thanks to both Walter Olson and Todd Zawicki, and also, she's invisible, but without Jenny none of this would have worked. So thanks again to everyone, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Great weekend. Thanks, Ryan.
Take care.
Thanks to all of you again.